I suddenly remembered my Charlemagne. Let my armies be the rocks and the trees and the birds in the sky.
If you're a little skeptical about the Charlemagne quote that I just played for you in the intro, then you've got good historical instincts. In his role as Indiana Jones' father, Sean Connery sounds awfully convincing, but in all likelihood, Charlemagne never said anything to that effect. After all, why would Charlemagne be seeking armies of rocks, trees, and birds when he had thousands of Franks eagerly awaiting his every command and fully prepared to march to the ends of Europe in his name? It doesn't make much sense to those well acquainted with the Carolingian art of war. But put yourself in the shoes of the general audience for a moment. Doesn't the quote at least sound authentic? Like it could have come from Charlemagne? Doesn't his very name evoke something vaguely biblical and otherworldly? These impressions, I would argue, have a lot to do with Charlemagne's fateful alliance with the Catholic papacy and with his assumption of an imperial diadem. At that point, Charlemagne became not only emperor, but also the Lord Steward on earth. This was an inheritance from the late Roman Christian emperors, who gave up the pretense of divinity and assumed the role of divine intermediary instead, entrusted with establishing justice, maintaining peace, and safeguarding the salvation of their subjects. It was a big job, maybe the biggest there ever was, and its responsibilities and powers extended over everything under the sun, people, birds, trees, and rocks alike. And as we will soon see, Charlemagne took the job description literally, concerned with even the minutest details of his realm. But before we delve into all of that, let's discuss the precise moment when Charlemagne was crowned as emperor. As those of you coming straight from the last episode will know, getting to this point had not been easy. Much like his father and grandfather, Charlemagne was almost perpetually on campaign, his conquests taking him further than any of his predecessors could have dreamed of. Since the coronation of his father, Pepin the Short, the territory under Frankish control had doubled in size. By now, Charlemagne had mastered the art of wartime logistics and organization, handed down new ways of governance and worship to conquered peoples, and soon he would inaugurate the Carolingian Renaissance, a period of renewed interest in the arts, sciences, and learning in general. His gifts in war and peace made him a worthy successor to Caesar and Augustus, and the moment now came for him to be recognized as such. It happened during Mass on Christmas Day, 800 AD, in Old St. Peter's Basilica, which was built upon the bones of martyrs in the Eternal City of Rome. The time and place couldn't have been better chosen if Charlemagne himself had planned it. I say that because, according to the traditional story, the coronation came as a complete surprise to him. Ostensibly, Charlemagne had been in Rome for other reasons, and while he attended Mass like the pious ruler he was, the Pope at the time, Pope Leo II, supposedly sprung a sort of ambush while Charlemagne was kneeling in prayer. Placing the crown on his bent head, the Pope named our unsuspecting protagonist Emperor of the Romans right then and there. At least, that is the version of events we get from our lead narrator for Charlemagne's life and times, Einhard, who said, quote, "Charlemagne at first had such an aversion to the imperial titles that he declared that he would not have set foot in the church the day that they were conferred, although it was a great feast day, if he could have foreseen the design of the Pope." End quote. So we are honestly meant to believe that Charlemagne was just as surprised as everybody around him by this turn of events, despite the fact that even contemporary sources had to acknowledge that Charlemagne's crown had been clearly visible on the altar it was sitting on. It's a little like hearing about Julius Caesar being surprised when his right-hand man, Mark Antony, very publicly offered him a crown. In both cases, we are meant to get the picture of a reluctant ruler. Someone like Jon Snow of Game of Thrones, the type of figure who was not attracted to power, but received it all the same. However, the truth is that every part of Charlemagne's coronation was carefully planned ahead of time by both parties, right down to every little detail. In the preceding months, the Pope and Emperor-to-be had plenty of time to talk things over. Only 1 year earlier, the Pope had found solace in Charlemagne's court after being chased out of Rome by an angry mob bent on plucking out his eyes and tongue on the grounds of simony, perjury, and lasciviousness. These were the sort of corruption charges usually leveled at Renaissance popes in the lead-up to the Reformation, at which time we almost come to expect such behavior from the successors of the Borgias. But in these early days of the Middle Ages, such accusations were more serious, and they earned Pope Leo the reputation of being, in the words of one historian, among the shiftiest occupants of the throne of St. Peter during this time. But whatever we might think of him, Pope Leo was in an unenviable position, facing down everything from angry mobs to bickering patrician families to the ever-lingering threat of invasion. By this point, the Lombards might have been neutralized, but the crescent of Islam loomed ever more imposingly over the Mediterranean world. To his credit, Pope Leo did not give in. Instead, he embarked on a charm offensive, closely corresponding with Charlemagne and eventually sending him the keys to St. Peter's tomb, a clear signal of his intent to make the relationship official. The Carolingians and the popes had flirted with one another for a while now, exchanging military protection for legitimacy, but the time to tie the knot had come. It would be the start of a new order. If Islam was to be a religion of the sword and the safekeeping of a caliph, then Christianity would be a religion of two swords, the Pope with his spiritual sword and the Emperor with his material one. At least, that is how medieval theologians came to retroactively interpret this arrangement, plucking the idea of two swords straight from the Bible passage, Luke 22:38. According to the two swords doctrine, as historians now call it, there was to be one spiritual head and one temporal head presiding over the Christian faithful. Not one, but two heads to rule them all, and in the darkness, bring them closer to the light. The idea elegantly accompanied the so-called translatio imperii, i.e., the transfer of imperial control from the Romans to the Franks. In his book on the Holy Roman Empire, historian Peter Wilson described the transfer this way, saying, quote, "Like all powerful medieval ideas, this one was rooted in the Bible. The book of Daniel recounts how the Old Testament prophet responded to a request to interpret Nebuchadnezzar's dream about the future of his empire. Thanks to an influential reading by St. Jerome in the 4th century, this was understood as a succession of four world monarchies, Babylon, Persia, Macedonia, and Rome. The notion of empire was singular and exclusive. Empires could not coexist, but followed each other in a strict sequence that was epochal, involving the transfer of divinely ordained power and responsibility for humanity, rather than merely changes of ruler or dynasty. The Roman Empire had to continue, since the appearance of a fifth monarchy would invalidate Daniel's prophecy and contradict God's plan." End quote. As elaborate as all this theological and intellectual scaffolding sounds, there was just one problem. Well, actually a few, but we'll get to the rest of them later. The immediate problem was that the medieval world had another emperor, and one that also claimed to be heir to the Romans, arguably on firmer grounds. That emperor ruled the Greek-speaking eastern remnants of the Roman Empire. Today, we prefer to call it the Byzantine Empire, as its power base was not in Rome, but in Constantinople, formerly known as Byzantium. We spoke a little bit about the Byzantines in the last episode, but let's give them a proper introduction. Although the word Byzantine has come to refer to something bureaucratic and ineffectual, this is a disservice to the medieval Byzantines. Theirs was one of the most technologically and culturally sophisticated civilizations of the Middle Ages, and unlike the Franks, who had extended their rule well beyond the Roman frontier, into places untouched by Roman roads or aqueducts, The Byzantine Greeks mostly ruled over lands in present-day Greece and Turkey that had actually been long-established Roman provinces. At this time, the Byzantines were ruled not by an emperor, but an empress, the infamous Irene of Athens, a woman who had seized power from her son and blinded him. In case that seems gratuitously cruel to you, just know that it probably wasn't personal. The Byzantines just had this unfortunate habit of blinding political opponents, oftentimes family members, in order to disqualify them from rulership. Now, it remained to be seen whether the Byzantines would turn a blind eye, no pun intended, to Charlemagne's coronation. But because of his role in the event, Pope Leo had effectively severed ties with Empress Irene, a decision that had less to do with the fact that she was a woman, even less to do with her cruelty, but almost everything to do with geopolitical realities. Pope Leo's predecessors had already begun the process of distancing themselves from the Byzantines, who had retreated from the Italian peninsula and begun experimenting with different interpretations of Christianity, such as iconoclasm, the rejection of Catholic icons. This was still before the Great Schism and the establishment of the Eastern Orthodox Church, but that is where things were headed. In the meantime, Christendom was still united, but it had to contend with the problem of the two emperors, the Zwei-Kaiser problem, as it later came to be called in German. You now had two peoples, the Franks and the Byzantine Greeks, with the same aspirations of universal empire that the Romans had. It was a state of affairs much changed since the days of the 5th century, when the Byzantines had cutely regarded the Franks as sons of Rome. But as early as the 6th century, the Merovingian kings of the Franks had begun to outgrow such designations, asserting their own right to rule and replacing images of Roman emperors with images of themselves on the coins that they minted. Later, Charlemagne would have himself portrayed on coins in profile, garlanded with oak leaves, like a Caesar. But despite all of this, aside from one minor exception, no fighting would break out between the Franks and the Byzantines after Charlemagne's coronation. These two peoples learned to coexist, and despite the fact that neither recognized the other as heir to the Roman legacy, both acknowledged one another's imperial status. There had even been one point in time when Charlemagne and Irene mutually entertained the idea of marrying one another. Ultimately, nothing came out of it, except conversational fodder for those of us who like asking, what if? As for the relationship between the two swords, the Carolingian emperors and the popes, it proceeded in the opposite direction, from better to worse. There were no outright confrontations during Charlemagne's time, but his successors would not always be on the best of terms with the popes, to say the least. Later in his reign, Charlemagne himself seems to have regretted the decision to let the Pope coronate him, probably because he became less and less enthusiastic about the implications of being crowned by a Pope. Think about it for a second. If the Pope could make an emperor, did that not mean that he could unmake him as well? Charlemagne's successors would learn that lesson the hard way, as would many other medieval Catholic rulers. Once the Carolingians had played the part of kingmakers in Francia, now popes came to play that role for the entirety of Catholic Europe. Although at first they kept their spiritual sword sheathed, as it became honed and polished, they would brandish it with righteous fury to excommunicate rulers and call crusades. Almost exactly a millennium after Charlemagne's coronation, long after the popes had exhausted these powers, the new Charlemagne, Napoleon, seems to have learned from his predecessor's example, making a deliberate decision to crown himself instead of being invested with authority by the Pope. In that sense, Napoleon, with his instinctive grasp on the symbols of power, had more in common with the Romans. Even if their last emperors were Christian, none of them was ever crowned by a pope. Their imperial legitimacy was vouchsafed elsewhere, and they wore not crowns, but laurel wreaths, like the one Napoleon chose to wear in his ceremony. That brings us to a fundamental question about Charlemagne's empire-building project. Was it built on Roman foundations, or was it something new entirely? Though Charlemagne was called Emperor of the Romans, scholars then and now have never stopped debating the nature of his empire. For our part, we've already touched on some of the ways that the Carolingian Empire was distinct from the Roman one. To begin with, much of the territorial expanse ruled by the Carolingians lay far outside the former boundaries of the Roman Empire, and the Carolingian power base was not in Italy, but in a region called Austrasia that was never fully under Roman control. For those who would argue the reverse, that the Carolingian Empire was in fact a continuation of the Roman one, the obvious place to start would be with Carolingian titles and honorifics. We already know that Charlemagne was named Emperor of the Romans. However, in his official charters, he preferred to go by Charles, most serene Augustus crowned by God, the great peaceful emperor ruling the Roman Empire. It might just sound like a lengthier version of the first title, but there is something else about it worth honing in on. Specifically, the inclusion of the word peaceful. Because Charlemagne was so frequently at war, this may give us pause. Yet, there is an explanation for this idea of peace. Like the Romans, the Franks excelled in war, but they much preferred it when waged far from home. The reason why is that offensive wars afforded opportunities for enrichment through the acquisition of plunder, whereas defensive wars were far less profitable. At home, the Romans and Franks wanted order and stability. They wanted barbarians kept at bay and criminal elements punished. In other words, there was the idea of peace, the so-called fruit of justice. And both peoples looked upon the emperor, who was judge, jury, and executioner, to keep the peace. The same idea is foundational to the modern state, which is expected to monopolize violence and keep us far removed from it. The Franks and the Romans only went so far in this regard, but they were more successful than many other pre-modern peoples, so much so that we can conceive of the idea of Roman and Carolingian states. That is not the only commonality we see. Beyond the here and now, Roman and Frankish emperors alike were looked upon to provide guidance in the hereafter. We have already addressed the fact that these emperors were looked upon as God's stewards, charged by divine mandate to guide their subjects to salvation. And in this spiritual quest, the Carolingian emperors were aided not only by the popes, but also the Frankish nobility. These noblemen were literate, fluent in Latin, and could often trace their lineage back to the late antique period. At times, they were referred to in the old Roman way as the optimates, a Latin term translating to the best, referring not only to the best in rank and wealth, but also in moral character. At this point, you may be wondering, was this all just a lot of posturing? In actuality, how did all this intellectual scaffolding hold up? We will have our answers to these questions by the end of this episode, but for now it suffices to say that even if this was posturing, it was awfully necessary for the Carolingians to establish legitimacy. Up until relatively recently in Frankish history, the Carolingians were just another noble family serving the Merovingian kings. Therefore, interlinking ideas about the nature of rulership, the world, and God allowed them to justify their right to rule. These were ideas further developed in an intellectual movement known as the Carolingian Renaissance, characterized by the revival of classical knowledge, which serves as perhaps the greatest evidence in favor of continuity between the Romans and the Franks. Most people have heard of the Italian Renaissance of the 15th and 16th centuries, and of names like Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, and Machiavelli. By comparison, the Carolingian Renaissance gets a lot less love, even if there may have been no Italian Renaissance without the Carolingian one. Students of antiquity are always bemoaning the fact that only a tiny fraction of the ancient world has survived to this day. Well, Without the Carolingians, we would only have some fraction of that fraction. It was because of the Carolingian Renaissance that thousands of classical works survive to this day, which would otherwise have been lost to time. Of all the books written in Western Europe before Charlemagne's coronation, fewer than 2,000 survive to this day. By comparison, 9,000 books survive from the following century when the Carolingians ruled. And many of these books were laboriously handwritten copies of original Latin and Greek texts dating back hundreds of years, which had, up until recently, been shut away in Lombardy. We have long since lost many of the originals, but we still have the Carolingian copies that were produced in monasteries. So anyone who has read Cicero's Republic, or the works of Tacitus, Livy, or Polybius, has a Carolingian monk to thank. When the scholars of the Italian Renaissance read some of these copies, they mistook them for the Greco-Roman originals and figured that the clean and elegant style of handwriting that they encountered was ancient in origin. In reality, this handwriting was the product of the Frankish monks who gave us Carolingian minuscule. If you listened to our first series about the Akkadian Empire, then think back to what the Akkadians did with Sumerian cuneiform, because it's a little bit like that. Carolingian minuscule was the culmination of 3 centuries of experimentation with varying Roman scripts. As the first minuscule script, it pioneered the use of lowercase letters, making it easier to distinguish between titles, subtitles, and body text, something markedly more difficult when only uppercase letters were in use. The Gothic script, also known as black letter, which succeeded Carolingian minuscule, preserved the use of lowercase letters, but it was characterized by a comparatively more bold and ornate look, making it far more difficult to read up close. If you were to conjure up an image of a medieval letter in your head, it is probably this script, black letter, that you would be thinking of, instead of Carolingian minuscule, which, I would say, was ahead of its time. Despite it falling out of popularity, Carolingian minuscule was to make a comeback during the Italian Renaissance. After a few tweaks, it became humanist minuscule, which was stripped of Gothic ornamentality and marked a return to a more clean and legible script, clearly influenced by Carolingian handwriting. One can trace a more or less direct line from Carolingian minuscule through humanist minuscule to many of the fonts in common use today. In the information age, we prefer most of the stuff we read to be as legible as possible. It was no different in the Carolingian period, despite the fact that the ability to read and write was monopolized by a small monastic intelligentsia. Monks had already functioned as some of the most trusted agents of the Carolingian regime. They were not only missionaries, helping the Carolingians win the hearts and minds of the inhabitants of newly conquered territory, but also diplomats, having played an important role in forging the alliance with the papacy. On top of that, they frequently undertook pilgrimages to visit saintly remains or to transport them from place to place. I find them a seriously impressive bunch, well-traveled, clever, and full of conviction. They weren't always traveling, though. More and more began to lead a sedentary existence in the monasteries. From the year 768 to 855 AD, 30 cathedrals and over 400 monasteries went up, with the majority of these being built during Charlemagne's reign. These monasteries were not for the exclusive use of the monks who lived there. They were also a kind of hotel and restaurant for the Carolingians, nobles, and missionaries who passed by them. Those monasteries that were close to campaign routes were chock full of food and supplies for passing armies. In addition to fulfilling all of these functions, Charlemagne directed the monasteries to also become centers of intellectual life. This was the beginning of the monastic scriptorium, a place where books were read, copied, and written en masse. It had already been a phenomenon in the British Isles, and now monastic scriptoria began to spring up across the Carolingian Empire. What made the scriptorium viable in the first place was the development of the book, which was itself still a new invention. Not that long ago, people had still written things down on papyrus, which, because of the limitations of the material, better lent itself to use in scrolls rather than books. But then parchment came along, a more durable material compared to papyrus, and therefore more capable of withstanding the test of time. Hence why Carolingian copies outlasted so many original works. It all became possible when people caught on to the fact that they could write stuff down on animal skins, gradually perfecting the process of preparing these skins for writing. They began by soaking the skin in a lime solution so as to more easily discard the fat and hair, before cleansing the skin in lye, and finally stretching it on a frame and drying it. The finished parchment was then turned into pages, or in the language of medieval manuscripts, leaves, which were stacked on top of each other and stitched together between either hard or soft covers. Since the quality of parchment was so inconsistent, sometimes fine and sometimes coarse, it became an indicator of wealth. But there were other indicators too, easier for us to grasp in today's age when we take books for granted. There were, for example, book covers studded with jewels or made of carved ivory, silver, and gold. You could safely judge these books by their cover, as they were often beautiful on the inside too, consisting of elaborate illustrations and designs that accompanied the text. Speaking of the text, while most times it was written in black ink, a composition of soot, oak apples, and squid ink that now often appears to us a faded brown or yellow, illustrations tended to make use of rarer pigments, like blue, gold, and silver, which still bedazzle us today. As a consequence, these illuminated manuscripts, with their hard-won splashes of color, constitute some of the most enduring works of medieval art. The American financier J.P. Morgan bought one of these manuscripts, the Lindau Gospels, and it apparently was enough to turn him into something of a medievalist. The elite of the Carolingian age also collected these manuscripts, and we see the emergence of private libraries in their palaces and estates, some of which went from having dozens to hundreds of books during this time. Charlemagne's library was the most extensive of all, and he assembled a court of the finest minds of his age, who formed a cross between a book club and an elite circle of advisors. This despite the fact that he never quite mastered the art of writing, and much preferred being read to, rather than sitting hunched over a book himself. One gets the impression that if he was alive today, Charlemagne would have been more of a podcast and audiobook guy, constantly soaking up information about a wide variety of topics. In his personal library, there were treatises on history, art, and law, and practical manuals about everything from the Latin language, to medicine and herbology, to astronomy and mathematics, complete with diagrams and drawings, something the new medium of books was far better suited to compared to scrolls. Although many of the books at this time, especially the original ones, were works of Christian theology, Charlemagne's library had no shortage of writings produced by Greek and Roman polytheists, that is to say, pagans. This was something monks were understandably nervous about, and we find many monasteries completely barren of these works, to the point that one of the leading intellectuals of this period publicly bemoaned the lack of rare classical texts in Francia, sending for some to be imported or copied in the British Isles. This is yet another battle in that tug of war between new and old, between preservation and innovation. Just like the Franks never stopped debating the nature of their empire, they never stopped debating the value of classical works. By this point, there was already a long tradition dating back to the 6th century of preserving classical works on the basis that, in spite of their pagan origins, they could be used as an aid for interpreting the Bible. Historian Rosamond McKittrick a leading expert on this period, wrote of the debate, quote, "With so much emphasis on Christian education and Christian learning, one is bound to ask what attitude the Frankish scholars of the Carolingian period had towards the pagan writings of classical antiquity. The obvious objection to the classical authors was their paganism. Added to this was the different moral sense and ethic they imparted. The Carolingians inherited the patristic attitude towards the classics in regarding them as a means to an end and as models for imitation in style. One monk summed the attitude up when he stated that the useful elements in the secular poets are so much grist to the human mill. What is not obviously useful, we wipe from our minds. And that applies, above all, to any mention of the heathen gods, love, or care of worldly things." A few scholars were violent in their opposition to the classical authors. Other Carolingians loved the classics and did their utmost to obtain copies of them. Charlemagne's palace library had a relatively large collection of rare classical texts, and one branch of classical learning in which the Carolingians were interested in for its content rather than for its language and style was the technical branch. End quote. Despite the fact that Charlemagne's favorite book was said to be Augustine's City of God, which was read aloud to him while he ate, bathed, and swam, his aforementioned library of classics makes it clear where he stood in this debate. We even hear of one occasion where the same scholar at Charlemagne's court, who complained about the lack of rare works in the realm, asked the emperor to borrow his copy of Pliny's Natural History. Moreover, Charlemagne made this position clear to his brainy court, saying, quote, "We are concerned to restore with diligent zeal the workshops of knowledge, which, through the negligence of our ancestors, have been well-nigh deserted. We invite others by our own example, as much as lies within our power, to learn to practice the liberal arts." End quote. The term liberal arts is often trotted out these days, but many don't realize that it has a formal designation, or at least it did, encompassing seven different areas of knowledge, the so-called trivium, grammar, rhetoric, and logic, as well as the quadrivium, music, geometry, arithmetic, and astronomy. Charlemagne really did lead by example, making multiple attempts to study all of these arts, and ensuring that his children did too. Although he spoke Frankish and Latin and could understand Greek, Charlemagne never really learned how to write in any of these languages. Nonetheless, he went on scribbling stuff down on various books and tablets that he kept stowed away under his pillow. His personal forays into learning and his assemblage of great minds were such that his court became a central node in the network of monastic scriptoria and palatial libraries. These great minds were united by their appreciation of the liberal arts and their devotion to the emperor. They were men who came from all over Europe, from York to Lombardy, and they helped Charlemagne run his vast empire while composing fawning poetry about him in the tradition of Virgil and comparing him to King David in the Old Testament. Because Charlemagne's rule was so itinerant in nature, his court must have been highly mobile. Those scholars who followed him from place to place remind one a little bit of the ones that followed Napoleon into Egypt, where they dug up the Rosetta Stone and single-handedly launched the field of Egyptology in the 19th century. Napoleon also enjoyed the company of intellectuals, but he advised against making one your wife or your minister, something that Charlemagne obviously felt different about, judging by his choice of ministers. With all that said, if we were to pinpoint an epicenter of intellectual life for the Carolingian period, it would undoubtedly be the city of Aachen. Called Aix-la-Chapelle in French, Aachen shows signs of life dating back to Neolithic times, and the Romans used it as a kind of spa resort due to its naturally occurring thermal springs. Although it was hailed as a new Rome by contemporaries, Admittedly, it was a far cry from the great cities of this period, like Constantinople and Baghdad. The most impressive feature of the city by far would be Charlemagne's palace complex. Built at the close of the 8th century, it was to the Carolingian Renaissance what St. Peter's Basilica was to the Italian one, although sadly, only a fraction of it remains standing today. This collection of palatial buildings included an imperial residence, council hall, treasury, throne room, gymnasium, barracks, and even a menagerie for exotic animals, such as peacocks and the Asian elephant, Abu Labas, a gift to Charlemagne from Harun al-Rashid, the famed Abbasid caliph portrayed in Arabian Nights. In addition to that, there was the thermal spring-fed bath system, its statues of pagan deities replaced with Christian saints. It was here that Charlemagne swam while having books read to him. On other occasions, he staged huge pool parties with as many as 100 courtiers and bodyguards at a time. Finally, there was the Palatine Chapel, the only part of the palace complex that has survived to this day, but only after centuries of renovations and restorations that have turned it into an extravagant work of bricolage, blending classical, Byzantine, and Baroque architectural styles. Crowned with an octagon-shaped dome and bronze parapets, the eye-popping blue and gold interior of this tall building is adorned with colorful mosaics and marble columns, the necessary inspiration and materials being sourced from Ravenna and Rome. In the Western Gallery, on a podium preceded by 6 stone steps, stands Charlemagne's marble throne. Though at first glance it appears to us quite plain, the Karl's throne, or throne of Charlemagne, is laden with biblical symbolism, and today it is believed that its materials were sourced from the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. In addition to serving as the coronal throne for later Holy Roman emperors, it was also immortalized in a lovely painting by the old French master, Henri Paul Mott. In this depiction, Napoleon, with his hand characteristically tucked inside his coat, stands at a respectful distance, only mounting the first of the 6 steps, as if Charlemagne, with his long legs outstretched before him, was still seated there. The real Napoleon disappoints us. He was less respectful, carting off entire columns from the chapel to France in the unsentimental fashion of a conqueror. Charlemagne would have the last laugh in the end, with most of what was stolen being returned to the chapel after Napoleon's fall. It's important to mention that the palace complex at Aachen was only one of 150 Carolingian palaces at this time, to say nothing of the 700 imperial estates, a major source of the family's wealth. These palaces were, for the most part, monumental in nature, meant to inspire awe rather than serving a defensive purpose. This is missed by those who would have us believe that the Carolingians basically built a bunch of castles and invented feudalism. Many of the family's palaces were constructed near bodies of water, like the Rhine and Danube, which made them accessible by boat. In the lands north of the Alps, still lacking the infrastructure of parts of the Mediterranean world, this was the preferred way to travel, especially during the winter. Among these palaces, the one at Ingelheim was another important one, with Charlemagne's successors spending their summers there and their winters in Aachen. Unlike at Aachen, the palatial hall of Ingelheim left depictions of ancient heroes intact, with mosaics of Remus, Hannibal, and Alexander the Great rendered alongside Carolingian heroes like Charles Martel, Pippin, and Charlemagne. But of all the Carolingian palaces, Ingelheim included, Aachen was the most important one, at least during Charlemagne's day. After his coronation as emperor, he spent more and more of his time in this expansive palace complex, from where he could issue his many legal decrees and charters, meet with advisors and ambassadors, enact currency reforms, hold feasts, and otherwise ensure the smooth functioning of his empire. That brings us to the topic of administration, which will reveal to us the true nature of Charlemagne's rule. This is the key to understanding how, after his conquests, he managed to hold on to such an enormous sweep of territory, amounting to roughly 450,000 square miles, or about 1.2 million square kilometers. This was Western Europe at its most unified, a feat that would not be repeated for another 1,000 years. France, Germany, Austria, Belgium, Switzerland, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, Northern Italy, and even parts of Eastern Europe were, at this time, all answerable to one emperor. The traditional narrative tells us that the Carolingian experiment in empire building yielded feudalism as its byproduct, categorizing a population of some 10 million or more into a taxonomy of those who fought, those who prayed, and those who worked with their hands. In other words, the nobility, the clergy, and the serfs. More recently, historians have made the case that feudalism emerged not by any such revolution, but rather because of an evolution that may have begun with the Carolingians, but only reached fruition in the 11th century, the starting point of the High Middle Ages. This was when long-established dynasties and cities, as well as up-and-coming institutions like guilds, universities, and knightly orders, all became sufficiently entrenched to atomize power. These actors created the sort of world that looks a lot more like what we imagine when someone brings up the Middle Ages. The Carolingians weren't quite there yet, and there is no clear consensus among experts about whether their empire was fundamentally antique or medieval in nature. Nonetheless, there is still quite a bit that we do know, so let's unpack some of it and begin to draw some conclusions. We'll begin with the nobility, those who fought. Most nobles were counts, a holdover from the Merovingian age. The majority of these counts acted as administrators, ruling counties, although some were merely part of the imperial household. It is believed that the empire had up to 600 counties, with the more developed of these composed of cities, villages, and monasteries alike. This was before counties became hereditary, although many counts remained in office until their deaths and passed their lands and titles to their children. This process only really ossified in the late 9th and 10th centuries. In the time of Charlemagne, counts were appointed, and the title could be revoked at any time. In addition to the count, there was the missus dominicus, Latin for envoy of the Lord. These imperial inspectors had been around during Merovingian times too, but to a far more limited degree than under Charlemagne. Now there were a lot more of them, and their authority was formalized. They had the power to preside over courts of law, receive oaths on behalf of the emperor, and survey counties. Ultimately, this was a sort of check on the counts, an innovation that was not to outlast Charlemagne due to the breakdown of imperial power. Besides the count and the missus dominicus, there was the newly invented marcher lord. These lords ruled marches on the frontiers of the empire, their lands heavily garrisoned and fortified. This was another logical innovation in light of the constant expansion that occurred under Charlemagne's reign. Last of all, there was the duke, who also tended to rule in the frontier regions and only appeared at the end of the Carolingian period. Under Charlemagne, you still mostly had counts, with power being measured not by a fancier title, but instead through patronage, influence, and wealth. That is to say, some counts were a lot more powerful than others. To drive the point home that this was not yet feudalism, it's necessary to mention that vassalage as a concept was still in its incipience. In his legal decrees, Charlemagne had specified that the well-off were to perform military service and swear personal oaths of loyalty to him, but the less well-off were expected to do the same. With the High Middle Ages and the advent of peasant levies, that would change. The authors of an authoritative book on the period, The Carolingian World, put it like this, saying, quote, "The vassal, who held land in return for military service, an important prop in the traditional construction of feudalism, is nowhere to be found in the Carolingian world. The central fact of the Carolingian countryside was thus the complex interaction between the steepening of the social hierarchy, leading to longer and more formal ties of patronage on the one hand, and on the other, a continued understanding of Frankish society as based on the community of free landowners acting collectively. End quote. In essence, there was still this residue of Merovingian-era leader-followerism, but it was now challenged by Charlemagne's vigorous attempts at imperial governance, which harkened back to the sophisticated administration of the Romans. And these attempts extended to spiritual matters, in other words, to those who prayed. There were something like 180 bishoprics in the Carolingian Empire, with only 45 of these under papal control. Although Charlemagne was meant to only wield the material sword, leaving the spiritual one to the Pope, by now you may have caught on to the fact that sharing power did not come naturally to a man like Charlemagne. He got himself involved in the affairs of the clergy to an extent that would have made even King Chilperic from our Merovingian episode blush, a king who was infamous for being overly involved in theological affairs. But unlike with Chilperic, there seems to have been good reason for Charlemagne's involvement, as well as recent precedents that made it more palpable. By the start of Charlemagne's reign, there had been an observable decline in the quality of sermons, liturgies, and ecclesiastical discipline, possibly as a consequence of either the proliferation in men of the cloth, or the attempts of his father and grandfather to bring these men to heel. As we know, Charlemagne conquered much, built much, and proselytized much, and this bought him the legitimacy necessary to fix the problem that he was in some ways contributing to. Therefore, we see Charlemagne hold religious councils, impose a new liturgical standard, and set down firm requirements of monasteries and churches. He ensured that sermons were well delivered and translated to local vernaculars, and even chimed in on the contents of these orations in an effort to bring uniformity and quality assurance to the pulpit. In one of his proclamations on the subject, Charlemagne said, quote, "Correct properly the Catholic books, for too often, while people want to pray to God in proper fashion, they yet pray improperly because of uncorrected books." End quote. Basically, this was a case of sermon supply chain management, if you will. But Charlemagne's intense involvement in ecclesiastical activities set a further precedent for his successors, who wouldn't be quite as skillful or as successful as him in managing the relationship with the clergy and Pope. This is a topic for the next episode, so for now, let us turn to our last group, those who worked with their hands. This is you and me, the everyday man, who accounted for the largest segment of the empire's population by far. It was not an easy life. Most people toiled away for most of their waking hours, working the land with wooden implements like the plow. Although the iron plow and the watermill had both been invented by now, their diffusion was a slow and gradual process. That is why, perhaps, the chroniclers of the period pay little attention to these innovations. They could not know that the plow and the mill would help transform the European economy in anticipation of the High Middle Ages. As the Silicon Valley saying goes, the future had arrived, it just wasn't evenly distributed. Like with raising crops, raising animals was also a story of drudgery and deficiency, with flocks being smaller than those that had once grazed the provinces of Roman Gaul. There was still some chance of adventure and advancement, though. If Charlemagne's summons came while you were a young man, then you would join the emperor on campaign, furnished with weapons and supplies bought by your community, with everybody pitching in a silver coin or two. If luck was on your side, you could strike it rich after a successful raid or siege in distant lands. This probably happened to at least a few poor Franks after the defeat of the Avar Confederation in present-day Hungary, where enough booty had accumulated over the decades of raiding that the transfer of wealth from the Avars to the Franks was a notable enough phenomenon to be singled out in the annals. But ill fortune was just as likely, if not more so, to befall you. Whether you were young or old, insidious threats loomed on the horizon. Raiders, robbers, diseases, natural disasters, and famines induced by summer droughts and winter frosts. While at the very highest level, the trappings of power grew in sophistication, here in the countryside, it was all much simpler. If you never worried about putting food on the table, then that in itself was a sign of power. Speaking of putting food on the table, the average diet consisted of bread made from rye, corn, oats, and wheat, which could be chased down by beans, cheeses, eggs, and ale. Larger estates, like the ones owned directly by the Carolingians, grew vegetables and fruit, and also had a more bountiful supply of wine, honey, and spices. If you did not live in one of these large estates, then you weren't completely out of luck when it came to these delicacies. This was a time when Europe was still covered in woodlands. Thus, you could easily stumble upon honey and fruit in a nearby forest, where charcoal, lumber, meats, and pelts were also sourced. In sum, the unfortified, ramshackle wooden villa, or village, that you probably called home, inducted you into a culture of self-sufficiency, collective ownership, and shifting settlement. Because buildings were abandoned and thrown up again in new locations in the face of natural disasters, crumbling infrastructure, and rural exploitation, you probably didn't get used to staying in one place for too long. There was this consolation, though. Death was certain, but taxes, not so much. Like in the Merovingian era, there is some mention of taxation in our sources, but not that frequently. Given that taxation serves as a sort of litmus test for administrative efficiency all throughout history, this is a little bit of a disappointing reality that belies our notions about Carolingian rule. In a trend that would continue throughout the Middle Ages, we hear that taxes are imposed on the use of certain equipment and infrastructure, hence the wheel tax, bridge tax, and port tax. But otherwise, money would trickle, if not pour, into the Carolingian treasury by other means, like fines, gifts, and tolls, with the latter of these essentially being interchangeable with the forms of taxation I just mentioned. In the days of Roman rule, things had been different. You had a more sophisticated system of taxation, a standing army, a highly specialized Mediterranean commercial network, and well-maintained infrastructure. The stone and brick villas of the Roman imperial period, now in ruins, looked more like what we think of when we hear that word, owned by patricians and run by slaves. As I have alluded to already, power in the Carolingian countryside was less formalized. The Carolingian World's authors write, quote, "Villages were tied into the patronage networks that made the empire tick via well-connected local priests and estate managers, who were members of rural communities themselves rather than agents imposed from outside," end quote. The picture the authors paint is more laissez-faire than we might expect. Charlemagne's many reforms notwithstanding, the influence of the Count and the Missus Dominicus seem to have been indirect, and although these imperial agents may have frequently been on the move, either to pay homage in the imperial court, to carry out their official duties in the city, to partake in a hunt or a feast, or to go off to war, they tended to be far removed from the hubbub of everyday village life. That brings us to the question. Besides presiding over the appointment of these many imperial agents, what were some of Charlemagne's other reforms? How else did he attempt to improve the lot of his people here on earth rather than in the hereafter? One reform often attributed to Charlemagne is almost symbolic of a golden age coming to an end. In response to the poor condition of the sou, a gold coin in circulation at that time, the silver denarius was minted to replace it. The process had actually begun with Charlemagne's father, Pepin the Short, who switched to a silver standard in response to the contraction of Mediterranean trade. For a little bit of context, the collapse of the Western Roman Empire and the rise of Islam disrupted long-time trade patterns and Europe's gold supply was compromised. Charlemagne's significance lay in carrying Pepin's reform forward and spreading it beyond Francia to the other parts of Europe that were under his control. He also took measures to retain direct control over the mints and ensure uniformity of the coinage. It was a similar story with Charlemagne's legal reforms. He drew on a fairly extensive legal tradition, and no universal law code was codified during his reign. Whereas during Roman times there had been the gestae municipalia, municipal document registers that kept records of legal transactions, the monastic scriptoria filled that role during Carolingian times. Furthermore, old codes and precedents dating back to the late antique period were debated, revised, and written down, in some cases for the first time. These regional codes and precedents were less ironclad than the laws of a modern state. They were more like suggestions, often serving as a starting point in the arbitration of disputes and dispensation of justice, which was left up to community leaders. Perhaps the most important of the precedents that the Carolingians drew on was the banum, a word of Germanic origin dating back to the 5th century, and essentially encapsulating the concept of the right to rule. More specifically, it had begun under the Merovingian kings as the right to call free men to arms, but by Charlemagne's time it expanded into a whole series of rights and responsibilities enshrined in legal decrees called capitularies. The capitulary was organized into chapters, capitulae in Latin, hence the name, and its applicability was varied. Whether it came to demanding oaths of loyalty, outlawing Saxon paganism, or even correcting minor abuses, the capitulary served as the primary vehicle for expressing imperial authority. It was the ultimate expression of Charlemagne's will, tempered as it was by his closest advisors. With a quick Google search, you can find a lot of these capitularies online, and some of them read like bullet-pointed lists of regulations and instructions for land and resource management. The Capitulary of 802 is a good example, providing guidance on everything from income and expense tracking, to animal husbandry, to the provision of baggage trains. It went so far as to remind those involved in food preparation to wash their hands, something that was in all likelihood quite important for the prevention of disease. But whether those actually working with their hands listened to Charlemagne is another story. And judging from his later capitularies, which are a little bit whining in nature, Charlemagne seems to have bemoaned the fact that the people of his empire were not listening to him. The authors of the Carolingian world, who we can turn to once again, tell us, quote, "The capitularies rarely had much to say on procedure, but were obsessed with structure and establishing chains of command, repeated injunctions to counts and missi to refuse bribes, to hold courts in appropriate settings and not in their vassals' houses, and to refrain from cutting short judicial hearings to go hunting, are backhanded evidence not for corruption, but for the Carolingians' drive to persuade their aristocratic followers to consider themselves royal agents and to follow certain codes of behavior when they were on the king's business." End quote. That is kind of what we would expect from a period in transition, right? When the distinctions between landowners and laborers was not as clear as the antique period and the High Middle Ages. Again, that trace of leader-followerism lingered, and in his capitularies, Charlemagne takes the tone not of a dictator, but a persuader. Before his coronation, only a dozen capitularies were issued, with the vast majority coming afterward. In total, we get something like 80 capitularies during Charlemagne's reign, a testament to the power he held compared to his predecessors and successors alike, who only managed to pump out a handful more between them. By comparison to the capitulary, the land charter was far more prolific. This was a document addressing one or more aspects of land management, like for example its sale, lease, transference, inheritance, or inventory of goods and supplies. It is the Carolingian period's 1,000 or so charters that, alongside archaeological evidence, shape our understanding of what life was actually like on the ground. Ultimately, what we can say is this. Even if the Carolingians did not quite top the ancient Romans, that was a tall order. so we have to give credit where credit is due. Compared to the Merovingian era, there had been real progress in Charlemagne's day, an observable increase in the exploitation of arable land, and evidence of increased specialization. As destitute as the Carolingian countryside might have sounded in my description of it, things had probably been worse under the Merovingians. It's simply that we don't know as much because of the comparative lack of documentation. Furthermore, at least a small part of the countryside's destitution was actually a product of its success in specialization. That is because specialization has an insidious side. In the jargon of economics, this is because when scarce economic resources, i.e. land and labor, are allocated toward the production of non-essential goods, economic shocks can produce more negative outcomes. In other words, when more and more farmers decide to hang up their plows and start blacksmithing or woodworking, a disease or natural disaster are all the more likely to produce famines that a specialized population is ill-equipped to respond to. Nonetheless, specialization is a characteristic of any sufficiently sophisticated economy, and it was a natural outcome of increased agricultural productivity in this era. Although trade can be an outcome of specialization, for the lands and peoples that came under the influence of the Carolingians, trade was more limited in scope than we might expect. By comparison, the Mediterranean trade network that flourished under the Romans was a lot more significant to their economy. Fundamentally, that is because it was easier in those days to travel by sea than by road, especially when traveling north of the Alps. Furthermore, the Romans had centuries to build their trade network, whereas the Carolingians had only had decades so far. That is to say, nothing of the unique tectonic and climatic characteristics of the Mediterranean coast, which, because of its variance from region to region, was an ideal staging ground for the prototype of a market economy. In the end, Charlemagne could only play the hand he was dealt, which he played very well, achieving in his lifetime more than perhaps any other monarch in the Middle Ages. Therefore, it's well worth our time to say a thing or two about the man of the hour. Up to this point, descriptions of his character have interspersed the larger narrative, but let's come to a conclusion about what made Charlemagne tick. As a starting point, we can turn to his earliest biographer, Einhard, who drew on an extensive set of first-hand experiences to paint a pretty revealing portrait of the man. Einhard said, quote, "Charlemagne's body was large and strong, his stature tall but not ungainly, for the measure of his height was 7 times the length of his own feet. His eyes were very large and piercing, his nose was rather larger than his usual, he had beautiful white hair, and his expression was brisk and cheerful, so that whether sitting or standing, his appearance was dignified and impressive. Although his neck was rather thick and short, and he was somewhat corpulent, this was not noticed owing to the good proportions of the rest of his body. His step was firm, and the whole carriage of his body manly. His voice was clear, but hardly so strong as you would have expected. He had good health, but for 4 years before his death was frequently attacked by fevers, and at last was lame of one foot. Even then he followed his own opinion rather than the advice of his doctors, whom he almost hated, because they advised him to give up the roast meat to which he was accustomed and eat boiled instead. He constantly took exercise both by riding and hunting. This was a national habit, for there is hardly any race on the earth that can be placed on equality with the Franks in this respect. He took delight in the vapor of naturally hot waters and constantly practiced swimming, in which he was so proficient that no one could be fairly regarded as his superior. Partly for this reason, he built his palace at Aix, and lived there continuously during the last years of his life, up to the time of his death. He used to invite not only his sons to the bath, but also his nobles and friends, and at times even a great number of his followers and bodyguards." End quote. This passage forms the basis for much of what we know about Charlemagne the man. The fact that his height is the first thing to come up is unsurprising. and the topic is of enduring fascination today, with estimates ranging from 5'9 to 6'5. However tall Charlemagne actually was, this was a figure that towered over his contemporaries, both in stature and in other ways. Although he had a reputation for temperance in eating and drinking, an aging Charlemagne developed what one historian has called a pot belly, something that we hear Einhard more delicately confirm. This may have been a consequence of the many feasts that Charlemagne presided over, during which he ate his fill and wore finely embroidered, bejeweled clothing that made this tall and bushy mustached ruler even harder to miss. Under normal circumstances, Charlemagne is said to have endearingly preferred the sort of attire that the everyday people of his empire wore. But at feasts and other imperial ceremonies, it was important that the emperor looked the part. After all, these sorts of events presented a unique opportunity to him, a bloodless ritual that bound the Frankish nobility to him. Another way Charlemagne achieved this was through hunts. Although not quite as bloodless as feasts, hunts were still a safer way to expend the energies and passions of Frankish noblemen outside of campaigning. We heard from Einhard already that he considered the Franks unrivaled hunters at this time, and it can perhaps be said that if war was their ultimate sport, hunting was a close second. That is why noble assemblies concluded with hunts, a welcome respite from the sometimes dull political and ecclesiastical discussions that increasingly came to dominate such proceedings. Like Einhard mentions, Charlemagne himself took part in a great many of these hunts. This was a sportsman who had hunted and ridden his whole life and also enjoyed swimming. His was a life in motion, exceptional even for the peripatetic Franks. One day, many years from now, Americans would call Theodore Roosevelt the steam engine in trousers, a nod to his energy that simultaneously associated him with a symbol of progress. In that vein, we might imagine the Franks calling Charlemagne something like the watermill in breeches. Charlemagne traveled hundreds, if not thousands, of miles each year. During one particularly busy year, his travels amounted to just under 2,000 miles, or roughly 3,000 kilometers. This was a man who kept himself busy, constantly campaigning, hunting, overseeing assemblies, organizing feasts, dictating capitularies, or surveying the many lands under his control as he bounced between the 150 palaces and 700 estates that he owned, probably exhausting the advisors and family members that accompanied him. Even so, Charlemagne was a family man, another of his endearing qualities. Einhard tells us, quote, "He had such care of the upbringing of his sons and daughters that he never dined without them when he was at home, and never traveled without them. His sons rode along with him, and his daughters followed in the rear. Some of his guards, chosen for this very purpose, watched the end of the line of march where his daughters traveled. They were very beautiful and much beloved by their father, and therefore it is strange that he would give them in marriage to no one, either among his own people or of a foreign state. But up to his death he kept them all at home, saying that he could not forego their society." End quote. Charlemagne's seclusion of his daughters was to be incessantly gossiped about, but this may have simply been his way of preventing an ambitious son-in-law from giving his successor unnecessary trouble. In any case, his daughters were to take lovers and have multiple children out of wedlock, who received Charlemagne's unconditional affections all the same. As for Charlemagne himself, after 5 wives and many more concubines, he sired 18 children, chastity never quite being one of his more conspicuous virtues, as one famous historian put it. Even if he was survived by only one legitimate son, this was the start of a formidable bloodline. The great dynasties of the Holy Roman Empire and France alike, the Capetians, Ottonians, Luxembourgs, and Habsburgs, were all to claim direct descent from Charlemagne, making his title of Father of Europe all the more fitting. But we have still not answered the question, what was the essence of the man? It's not easy to say. We have a few biographies, but we don't have mounds of material to work with like with later figures. and what we do have is sometimes contradictory in nature. There is a certain dichotomy that we cannot fail to have recognized by now in the many facets of Charlemagne's life and times. There was temperance and excess, simplicity and extravagance, civilization and barbarism, and at the highest level, the antique and the medieval. If I were to single out just one running thread in the great tapestry of Charlemagne's life, then I suppose it would be his restlessness. That, I would argue, is Charlemagne's essence, which he applied in the war tent and the council hall in equal measure. Charlemagne was constantly on the move, managing only a few hours of shut-eye here and there. Known to rise from his bed several times each night, one can vividly imagine candlelight scenes of our insomniac emperor, scribbling away in a book or reading over the draft of a capitulary. Sometimes it all took a toll on him, yet even if he was too tired to rise from bed the next day, Charlemagne resorted to summoning his advisors to his bedside in order to dictate aloud to them. It was the sort of unstately display that only a master statesman could afford, like Winston Churchill a millennium later, who had the same habit, sometimes not rising from his bed until noon. But as he approached the age of 60, a much longer slumber awaited Charlemagne, one that did not come as a complete surprise. Einhard said that as Charlemagne was unsettled by fevers, so too were the heavens unsettled by a succession of solar and lunar eclipses. But whether or not his death was written in the stars, Charlemagne seems to have been all too aware of his impending death. Only a year prior, he had summoned his sole surviving legitimate son to court in order to crown him as co-emperor and heir. And yet, concerns about his mortality notwithstanding, he spent the last autumn of his life hunting before falling ill and drawing his last breath on the morning of January 28, 814 AD. In a famous poem describing his final moments, Charlemagne is said to have uttered, "My warlike hand, once famous throughout the world, now shakes as my blood grows cold." His funeral took place the same day, and he was interred in a marble sarcophagus inside his beloved Aachen Palace Chapel. A grieving monk at the time, overcome with emotion, said, quote, "From the lands where the sun rises to western shores, people are crying and wailing. The Franks, the Romans, all Christians are stung with mourning and great worry. The young and old, glorious nobles, all lament the loss of their Caesar. The world laments the death of Charles. O Christ, you who govern the heavenly host, grant a peaceful place to Charles in your kingdom. Alas for miserable me." End quote. In his final will and testament, Charlemagne left most of his wealth and his book collection to the church, wanting it to be used for charitable purposes. As politically motivated as a lot of his decisions seem to our cynical, modern eyes, this was the final pious act of someone who was, in the end, a pious individual, who lived and died by his faith, even if he weaponized it. Since he had outlived all of his legitimate sons except for one named Louis, the realm would not fracture, but instead passed in its entirety to him. What comes of his successors is a story for another time. For now, it suffices to say that Louis was no Charlemagne. The world would not see the likes of a Charlemagne for many centuries, however much people hoped and prayed that it could be otherwise. Long after he had died, a rumor began that he would return in the end times, that for the time being, he was not dead, but only resting. My only contention is this: the Charlemagne we know would never have stayed put this long. Hey guys, I hope you enjoyed this episode. The plan for the next one is to cover the rest of the Carolingian period, which was a time of decline, before we get to the official start of the Holy Roman Empire. So We have laid down a lot of context, but we're finally getting to the premise of the series. In the meantime, though, I did want to share the sources that I've used in this episode as well as the last one. So they are as follows. So probably the number one source is Rosamond McKittrick's The Frankish Kingdoms Under the Carolingians, 751 to 987. There's also The Carolingian World, which was quoted from several times, written by Marios Costambis, Matthew Innes, and Simon MacLean. There is Heart of Europe, which will be used going forward as well, along with some of these other works too. That one was written by Peter Wilson. There is the work by Guy Halsall. He wrote Warfare and Society in the Barbarian West, 450 to 900. Obviously, with his book, it was especially useful for the last episode. As far as primary sources go, it's mainly Einhard, both his Royal Frankish Annals as well as his Life of Charlemagne. And I want to recommend a few more places you can go if you really enjoyed this episode and if you want to dig your teeth into this period. So the first of these would be the Early Middle Ages course by Paul Friedman, a lecture series from this professor who teaches at Yale, covering a large chunk of the period that we focused on, and even more than that. So if you're audio inclined, as I imagine many of you are, given that you're listening to a podcast, then I think you'll really enjoy it. It's all available on YouTube, so go check it out. And if you like documentaries, there's a pretty dated one, but entertaining all the same, by Kenneth Clark, an art historian, who did this series called Civilization, which was groundbreaking at the time. And part one is called By the Skin of Our Teeth, and he makes that old argument, which smells a little bit musty nowadays, right, a little bit dated, about the Carolingians saving Western civilization. But it's really, really enjoyable, and I highly recommend it. There's a YouTube channel called Ryan Reeves. That's the name of the channel and the person behind it. And this guy covers Charlemagne. He made a few videos years ago, and he recently got active again. And it's a ton of content about Dark Age church history specifically. We cover that quite extensively, right? The monks, the monasteries were a fascinating component of the Dark Ages. And as I said, really impressive guys. And Ryan Reeves, he covers church history primarily, but he has a dedicated video about Charlemagne and the Carolingian Renaissance, and it's very wonderful. And lastly, there's this channel called Four Keys Book Arts. And so if you enjoyed the little segment about the production of books during this time, you can actually go check out how books during this period were made. There's a multi-part series covering every detail of the process. So that's really enjoyable if you want to dig in. So with that said, guys, thanks again for listening, and see you in the next episode.